10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program is going to be spent with Jessica DeBoer, a good friend to the morning show, well known to many of you as a very active music teacher here in the Kenosha area, and the coordinator of the Marvelous Fine Arts at First series. How's that? First United Methodist Church on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And this has been around for a while, and I forgot to look up just how many years Fine Arts at First has been in existence.
We're about to start our 15th season.
Holy cow.
I know. Wow. It's a big one that ends in a five.
Yeah. And how many of those 15 years have you been the coordinator?
I'm going to say seven or eight, something like that.
So roughly about half of them. Well, if it's a banner 15th anniversary year, we should talk at least for a couple of minutes about the beginning of it, which I'm pretty sure was done under the guidance of one David Scripsima.
That's correct, David Scripsima. About 15 years ago, our church received the gift, the beautiful, amazing gift of a Bursendorfer Concert Grand Piano. And we thought, well, we can't just play this on Sunday mornings in church. That's not enough. So we need to share this gift with the Kenosha Racine community and just show them what a beautiful piano it is and bring in artists that can play it and show off its amazing range and capabilities. And that's how Fine Arts at First got started.
Yeah. And here it is 15 years later and going strong, or going for sure.
That's right, going for sure.
It's a challenge, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, because these musicians, especially of this caliber, are not brought in for free, so there is quite a price tag attached. But it continues to be a concert series that, in a sense, is offered as a gift to the community.
That's correct. All of our concerts are free. There's no tickets. You don't need to buy a ticket. You don't need to pay a thing. You just come in the door and have a seat and enjoy world-class musicians.
So what makes that possible? What makes it possible to have these fine concerts and not tickets that people have to pay for?
All of our programs are funded through donations. We have some grants from the Kenosha Community Foundation, from the Racine Community Foundation. But other than that, all of our concerts are paid for by donations. And so we have loyal givers who give every year. We have people who just give now and then, but that's how all of our bills get paid.
Very good. Well, we certainly hope that as people hear about this, if this sounds like something that they want to help support, that they will take the opportunity to do so. And I'm sure before we're done, we'll be telling people information about how they can support Fine Arts at First. So I'm glad we're having this conversation today, because the 15th anniversary season is about to begin.
Yes, on Sunday.
And about to begin with what sounds like a really, really lovely concert. Tell us about it.
We are so excited to bring back Duo Diorama, and they were here several years ago, and they're just a wonderful pair, Minghwan Chu and Winston Choi. She plays the violin, and he plays the piano, and they are a husband and wife team as well. And they are just fantastic performers in their own right, but together they have been playing together for many years now, and they do chamber music of all varieties. They're going to be playing some Beethoven on Sunday. They're going to be playing some Ravel and Grieg, but then they're also going to be playing a piece that was just written for them. They're going to by a Chicago-based composer, Igor Santos, and the piece is called As Light Becomes Form, and they're going to be premiering it the night before in Chicago, and then they'll be playing it again on Sunday for us at Fine Arts First.
Wow. So how did you become acquainted with them, and when did they first play at Fine Arts?
They played here probably 3 or 4 years ago. But before that, Winston had played piano with a string quartet that had played on the series. And so when I was planning 1 year, it was like, David said, we should have him come back. And he and his wife do stuff, and she plays violin. And it was like, okay, let's see. And then they came, and it was a wonderful day. But I do remember that day they came a few years ago. It was the day of the Bears-Packers game, and I really screwed up by scheduling a concert the day of the Bears-Packers. Stupid me. So the audience was a little small, so I'm hoping that this time that we'll be able to have a much better audience, because that won't be a problem.
Right. And I'm sure part of what has you bringing people back is not just that they play well, but that they're lovely to deal with.
That's true. You know, they're wonderful people, and people here know them, and people here, you know, look forward to hearing them perform again. So we like to introduce our audiences to new groups, but we also love bringing back the people that we know and love and know that will give us a wonderful concert.
Terrific. So again, that will be this Sunday afternoon, violin and piano, a lovely chamber afternoon provided by this husband and wife team who bill themselves as Duo Diorama.
Yes.
And again, what time is the concert?
3 o'clock. The concert's at 3 o'clock. The doors to the audience open at 2:30, and you can come anytime after that and have a seat, and there'll be plenty of space. And so 3 o'clock.
And right now it looks like the forecast is for sunny and a high of 62.
Yeah, so. Darn it. we would rather prefer 45 and raining, but, that's all right.
That's all right. No, I think
go on a hike tomorrow and then come to the concert on Saturday.
That's right. Yes.
Sunday.
Right. Or get out there, but take a little break from the
garden. That's right.
You're doing. So very good. So concert number two is something that happens to be on my calendar as well.
Yay.
Which is Sunday night, December 15th.
That's right. Messiah. Hooray, hooray. This is our flagship concert. We love it so much. I'm so excited. Every year we have our sing-along Messiah, where we do portions of the entire work. Don't worry, it's not the entire Messiah. That's a long night. But no, we only do some portions of it. We have a full 30-piece orchestra. We have soloists. And we have beautiful Christmas decorations and candles in our sanctuary. And it really is the highlight of everyone's Christmas season, including the performers. I get all the emails. I send out an email to the orchestra members and say, are you available? Please come play for Messiah. And everyone that sends back an email says, yes, I can't wait. It's my favorite concert. So we just love it. Love it.
Well, and towards that end, I think it's really cool that, for instance, the young man who's been the tenor soloist for the last several years, Nick Huff, who is now off doing all
kinds
of glorious things. Right. I mean, just sang in a world premiere in San Francisco with the Marola program, and now is down with the Florida Grand Opera singing in Mozart's Don Giovanni. But he is eager and excited to be back.
I'm so excited.
To be the tenor soloist
again.
That's
excellent.
And the young man who's been the bass soloist the last several years, Mike Anderley, he's coming all the way from Missouri, where he now lives and teaches. And so that says something, too, about this is a gig that they appreciate, the opportunity. How many people would you say, generally speaking, are in attendance for the Sing-Along Messiah?
We're right around 400 people. Right.
Wow.
Around 400. Yeah, it's a wonderful concert, and we just hope that every year we can bring in more and more and more people. And I always tell, I always tell everyone, if you haven't been, you just have to come. You have to come, because then once you come, you'll be like, oh, how did I miss this? Mm. How have I not been to this before? Because it's just such a wonderful experience for everybody. Although I always say, it's, you know, it's a sing-along Messiah, but you don't have to sing. You don't, you're not going to be pressed into service. You can just sit and enjoy. It is not a requirement that you sing.
Right.
So don't let that scare you off.
Right. But it's interesting, when you look out there, the vast majority of people who are there are singing.
Yes, and I don't think that we actually just said that Greg is the conductor of this concert. I don't think we mentioned that. That's an important thing, that we wouldn't have Messiah without Greg. So, you know, Greg brings in our wonderful soloists and conducts the orchestra and the choir every time. So we're so grateful.
It is a fun time. We should mention that. That there are scores that can be lent out if people don't have their own well-worn copies of Messiah themselves. And we should probably also mention that we at least do the best we can to have people seated by section.
Yes.
So if you're an alto, you'll be seated with other altos.
Right.
And that makes a difference, too, if
true.
You're a little nervous
it's
at the prospect.
It's not easy to sing. It's not. It's very difficult music. Even as a string player myself, I always appreciate playing it because it's not easy, and it's always just wonderful to have a little challenge.
Absolutely. And, of course, we try to choose those movements that are a little more singable. We pass
Absolutely,
over the
yes.
ones that are, like, backbreakingly difficult.
Right, there are some tough ones.
Yeah, but no, it ends up being a really lovely night, and for many people it kind of kicks off their holiday season or kicks it up a gear in excitement. So, again, that's going to be Sunday evening, December 15th. That begins at 6
o'clock.
Yes. Then my birthday in 2020.
Happy birthday to Greg.
Right. So I'll turn 60 the same day.
Oh,
that,
man.
Yeah, the same day that the Philharmonica String Quartet performs. So
excellent.
Tell us about this.
They are another group that has been with us before. It's been several years, though. And they're based in Milwaukee. And a lot of your listeners might recognize one of the violin players is Sasha Mandel, who is the concertmaster of both Racine and Kenosha Symphonies.
Mm.
So if you are
wonderful player.
Yes, if you're a regular to those concerts, then you'll know Sasha. And he and I have been friends for a long time. And so it's just nice to have your friends in your arsenal to say, hey, bring your wonderful, amazing string quartet and play in my concert series. Great, thanks. So he is one of the violinists, along with his wife, and then we have, of course, viola and cello, all members of Milwaukee Symphony and groups that perform up there. They're just fantastic, and they are going to be playing some Schumann, some Mozart, some Bach from the Art of the Fugue.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so we haven't had them in probably 5 or 6 years, so it'll be really great to have them back.
So explain to our listeners kind of the special magic that is part of a really good string quartet.
Oh, man. I'm
as a string player, you
yes, as
couldn't
a string
speak
player,
to this.
And I've been in string quartets for a long time. And I just, when you are working with the right group of people and the people that, you know, you work with them, you know them, and you just play together, it's just like a living, breathing organism. You're it's like a four-headed monster. And you and when you play with someone for so long, you just know what they're going to do. You know how to work with them. You know where they're going to go. And it just is this amazing synergy that comes alive for everybody to enjoy.
Right. One of the things I like about string quartets, maybe even more so than woodwind quintets or other kinds of ensembles that maybe mix a piano with strings, which is all wonderful in its own way. But there's something so cool about four instruments of the same family together and playing with incredible precision and sensitivity to one another. There's this cohesive whole that I'm not sure is duplicated in any other genre.
I agree. And it almost becomes like one giant instrument when everyone is working together. You know, you've got everybody from the cello all the way up to the high violins. It just sounds like one instrument when everyone's breathing together and playing together, and it just clicks.
Right.
Amazing.
And I think your sanctuary, although it's perfect for the sing-along Messiah and perfect with that grand piano and so on, but I also think it is a beautiful room for strings.
It is. It really is. And I like playing there, but yeah, I think, and I get feedback from performers that they enjoy playing there as well. So
yeah.
it does sounds good.
So February 16th, 2020, that'll be the Philharmonica String Quartet. And again, that's 3 o'clock
afternoon. Yep.
Very good.
Yep. So. They're all at 3 except Messiah, which is at 6. So.
Right. Very good. Then in March is a group that I have had some acquaintance with. As a matter of fact, I had the pleasure of directing the Bell Ensemble for their first concert of this current season.
Oh, nice.
That was up in Racine. That was their founder and artistic director, Nick Berudian. He and his wife just had their first child, their first baby.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and when he realized that the due date fell perilously close to the date of their first concert, he asked me early in the summer if I would be willing to step in and direct their first concert. I was happy to do so. So it was Echoes from the Abbey. It was a really lovely program of English music from the late 19th, early 20th century. It just had a ball. And it was a reminder to me, again, of what a neat
they
group
are,
this
yes,
is.
They
just
are
really
so
special.
They really are. And I've had the luxury of playing with them several concerts on viola. And they do such an incredibly interesting range of music. And one concert we did was this really early Schütz pieces, but then also some Erwo Pärt. And it was just an amazing blend of their repertoire that they program is just amazing.
Yeah, Nick and has a real gift for that.
Really is fascinating. And I'm so excited to be joining them in January. We're going to be doing a Mall in the Night Visitors.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm really happy to play in that orchestra. But they're coming in March for Fine Arts at First, and they're doing a concert called Miserere. And they're doing, again, another piece by Heinrich Schütz, which was composed in the mid-1600s. But then they're also going to do a piece by composer James McMillan, which is titled Miserere, and that was composed in 2009. So you have this huge range of dates that they are presenting, and the blend of their voices, and they have different performers at different times, but no matter who's singing with them, they just are fantastic singers, and it's such a neat concert, no matter what they do.
Right, yeah. So this group was created, in a sense, to give some more professional opportunities to young and really talented singers here in southeastern Wisconsin. So they draw from Milwaukee and Points West and so on.
Well, and it's these little chamber pieces. It's not like a giant choir where you're singing, you know, a piece you might have sung before. You know, these are these little intimate pieces and groups that, you know, do this repertoire that isn't always sung because it's not, you know, there's not a lot of groups like this out there to do it.
Absolutely. And the singers will, in a sense, I mean, although they always audition for every concert, but they also sort of self-select in the sense of, oh, I want to sing on this concert. This repertoire means a lot to me. So you end up with these singers who are a perfect match.
And different voices work better for different pieces too, I'm sure. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah, so that sounds like a really intriguing concert in which there'll be, as you said, ancient and new both.
Yes, and it's perfect for Lent. And so it's happening on March 29th. So right in the Lenten season, singing pieces of the St. John's Passion, Miserere. So it's a good complement to the season as
Fantastic.
Well.
Fantastic. So March 29th, again, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The Racine-based Bell Ensemble with Nick Berudian. And your concert season is going to finish out with something that has been something of a hallmark for at least many of your seasons, and I'm sure many people will be excited once again that the Fine Arts Jazz Ensemble will be in action.
Love it.
So, so for somebody listening who has never been to one of these performances, explain what we're talking about.
Sure. The Fine Arts Jazz Ensemble brings together performers from our area, the top guys in our area. So you have Mike Gudbauer, who is the band leader. He actually was a bassist who was living in Racine and Kenosha and playing in Racine and Kenosha, and several years ago moved to North Carolina. So he lives in North Carolina, but he comes back every year to do this gig along with a couple other gigs that he does every year. So he's the band leader. We have bass, drums, and piano. Mike Harris on piano, Paul Griffith on drums, and they are the backbone of the group. But then we also have trombone, trumpet, saxophones, and it's always the same guy. You know, it's almost always the same guys every year. They come together.
This tight circle of friends.
Yep, it's great, and they play. You know, we we alternate. So one year we highlight a specific performer. Last year we had a concert featuring the music of Cannonball Adderley, and we've done once in the past with other famous jazz greats. But then, and then on the alternate years, we do a feature, like, you know, we focus on, like this year, it's called the Jazz Menagerie. So all kinds of songs about animals. And in the past, we've had songs about travel or songs about the seasons. So it just depends on, you know, what Mike comes up with every year. And he always presents me with a bunch of options, and it's so hard to choose.
Mm.
But yeah, so this year we're going to the zoo with the jazz ensemble and visiting the Jazz Menagerie.
The Jazz Menagerie, what a cute idea.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to see two of these jazz concerts in past years, and one of the things that's always sort of amazing to me is how tight and together it will be, even though we're talking about, at least in some instances, musicians who have just gotten together.
Yeah, I mean, they just get together
that
day.
Yeah, it's not like
they've
been
run it and go.
Yeah, they haven't been practicing for weeks or anything, but they're the kind of musicians who just make the magic happen.
They just lay it down. It's amazing. They're great.
Super. So that's going to be on the 3rd of May.
Yes.
Oops, there's a wrong year on your website.
Oh, heavens. We'll get that fixed right away.
It says May 3rd, 2018.
Oh, well, we're not going to be time traveling to go to that concert, I promise.
Okay.
None of that. Just
all right.
2020.
So, very good.
Thank you. I'll get right on that.
So that's the Fine Arts series then for this coming year. Five concerts.
Nice
variation of various things, and as we said at the outset, this is a gift to the community, as it were. Although it's gifts that make it possible.
That's correct.
So tell our listeners the ways in which somebody can support Fine Arts at First if they really appreciate this and are in a position to help make it possible.
Absolutely. We definitely need your help. You know, we are arts organizations are always looking for support, financial support, and, you know, our support kind of fluctuates up and down. And so we definitely are always asking the public to help out. You can always send money to the church, that's First United Methodist Church. You can write a check to Fine Arts at First and send it over there. And our information for mailings on our website. And you can send us a donation. That would be a fantastic thing. Of course, all, you know, people who donate all get their names in the program on the back. We have a wonderful list of amazing supporters who are always there to help us out. But we can use, you know, any support that anyone wants to give would be fantastic. And of course, another way to support is just to come. Come and enjoy the concerts and bring your friends and neighbors and, you know, enjoy a free afternoon of wonderful music.
So what goes into your thinking as you ponder yet another season of Fine Arts at First and need to kind of get this all put together? I mean, what does that process typically look like?
It depends. I get a lot of cold calls. They're cold emails from people all over saying, oh, we have this brass group. We have this guitar duo. We have this, you know, chamber group that we want to come play on your concert series. And let's talk about what we could do. And so sometimes I just reach out to one of these people and say, hey, you know, we have some space. What, you know, tell me what you do if we're looking for a new group. But a lot of times we just reach out to those folks that we've had in the past that haven't been here for a while and say, hey, you know, why don't you come back and play? And they say, sure, absolutely. So, you know, that all sort of comes together in the spring for the next year. And then we, you know, we have to consider dates for Packer games. We have to consider dates for Kenosha Unified festivals. You know, we don't want to conflict with Orchestra Festival or Bandorama. And we have to also consider, you know, Parkside and Carthage and their dates and when they have concerts. So then we, you know, look at what's available and start slotting people in.
Doesn't sound particularly simple, and
it's
yet it's
not
seems,
simple at all. It's a giant puzzle.
Yeah. Is it mostly your puzzle?
Yes, I am. I am Fine Arts at First.
So ultimately, you get to make these choices then.
I do.
Which is actually a little simpler than
it is a lot simpler. But yes, I do. I kind of do it. I do it all. No, that's not true. I have a wonderful graphics guy who does all of the design and print, and he is amazing. His name's Shimon Croxton, and he does freelance stuff too, and he's just amazing. And so he makes us look great. He does the website. You know, I don't. But when it comes to coordinating, yeah, I put it all together.
Right.
So.
Well, you put it together very, very well, and this is something that I know a lot of people enjoy and appreciate. So let's circle back to where we began, namely this 15th anniversary season of Fine Arts at First and this first concert that is already coming up Sunday afternoon.
That's
so
right.
Remind our listeners about who is going to be playing on Sunday and what they're going to be playing and what people do, the when and where. And
sure. So our first concert is Sunday afternoon, 3:00 at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. We're on the corner of Sheridan and 60th. We have the big flashy sign out front. Everyone says, oh yeah, that church with the big flashy sign. That's us. And the concert starts at 3:00. The doors open at 2:30, and you're going to get to hear Duo Diorama. It's a violin and piano duo. They'll be playing music of Beethoven, Ravel, Grieg, and they'll be performing a piece that was written just for them that they premiere the night before by Chicago-based composer Igor Santos. And so that'll be the first time it's heard in Wisconsin, so you'll be at the Wisconsin premiere of a piece for violin and piano.
Very good. And it looks like the website is fineartsatfirst.org.
That's correct.
If people want more information about anything that we have talked about today. Jessica DeBoer, the coordinator for the Fine Arts at First series, celebrating its 15th anniversary season. Well, congratulations.
Happy anniversary. Thank you so much.
And happy anniversary to David Scripsimo, who,
of course,
got all this started all 15 rolling. Years ago. And we hope a lot of people will turn out on Sunday for what sounds like an exciting start to this newest season. And thank you, Jessica DeBoer, for being here for the morning show today.
Thanks for having me.
Part 2 from the archives coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. Seven the time. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part 2 from the archives. Anyone who is a musician or a music teacher and who wonders about the miracle of making music, and anyone who cares about educating our young people and the most effective ways to do that is sure to find all kinds of things to enjoy in a remarkable new book called Strings Attached: One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. This is the story of an extraordinary music teacher, a public music teacher by the name of Jerry Kupchinski, known affectionately as Mr. K, born in Ukraine, and he came to America with a mission to make the young people he worked with the finest musicians they could possibly be, with unwavering relentlessness and devotion to that task. This book about him has been co-written by two of his students, one of them his daughter, Melanie Kupchinski, a brilliantly talented violinist who plays with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The other author to whom I'm going to be speaking today is Joanne Lippman, who is a highly regarded journalist and has done all kinds of award-winning work for Portfolio, The Wall Street Journal, and she has supervised Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage at The Wall Street Journal. She has been a frequent commentator on public radio, on CNN. Her work has appeared in Newsweek, New York Times, and she has done a wonderful job of helping to bring to life this memorable figure in her own life, her own string teacher, Jerry Kupchinski. Again, this book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And Joanne Lipman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And I love what's said in the foreword of the book, that if Mr. K wasn't a real-life character, somebody would have had to invent him. And he does certainly resonate on the page as almost a figure out of a novel or a figure out of some great film. But instead, he was a flesh-and-blood man who influenced so many lives so powerfully, including your own. One of the things that's what's interesting about your perspective versus that of his daughter, Melanie, is that she has gone on to use music in her professional life and was a brilliant prodigy right from the start. Your own relationship to music, the discovery of your own talents, was a much more, shall we say, checkered experience. And, of course, you've gone on to a professional life that really hasn't included music to any meaningful full degree. Just talk for a moment about the interesting contrast between you and your co-author and what that felt like as you penned this book together.
Right, that's right. So Strings Attached, as you said, it tells the story of this one remarkable music teacher who changed the lives of thousands of students, whether they became musicians or whether they went into other fields. And in that sense, in the larger sense, it really is about the mentors that we all have in our own lives. And I do think that, you know, one of the reasons Strings Attached is resonating with people is because, I mean, he has a remarkable story. He was larger than life and had actually quite a tragic personal story. And the fact that he was able to translate that into a legacy of such joy for his students is quite remarkable. But I think a large reason it's resonating with people is because it reminds them of that person in their own life and how, you know, a great music teacher, like a great soccer coach or a great English professor, teaches you things that go so far beyond the classroom. And so for Melanie and myself, as you said, Melanie is a violinist with Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I went on to become a journalist. Yet we found that the lessons that he taught us, things like perseverance and resilience and self-confidence, are all of these qualities that translate no matter what sphere of life you're in. But doing it, as you mentioned, writing the book together was so rewarding, because what we do is we tell his story from two points of view. So we are the same age, Melanie and I. We grew up together. She was a child prodigy violinist, as was her younger sister, Stephanie. And I was just an ordinary student. But Mr. K, when I began taking viola lessons, put us all together in a quartet, and we performed together for our entire childhoods. And so that was like a wonderful experience, playing together, and we really learned about the passion, we developed a passion for music and really learned about the bonds that music creates among people who play it together. And the wonderful thing about writing the book was, so Melanie and I had gone our separate ways after high school and really lost touch with each other, and it wasn't until her father's memorial service, which we write about in the book, that we reconnected and started trading these stories about her dad, and realized that, you know, from my point of view, from the whiny student point of view, I saw the tough teacher not understanding or appreciating the difficulties and challenges and tragedies in his own life. And so the way we structure the book is with these two voices, where I tell the kind of outside whiny student perspective, and she tells you exactly the same thing that's going on inside his life, where there's, at the same moment, the kind of tragedies and challenges that he is confronting. Writing the book together felt, as it did when we were children, it felt like a duet. and we hope that it reads that way. It was a really, it was like trading melody and harmony back and forth between each other. It was quite a remarkable experience.
Very nicely put. And yes, I love the fact that we have two different voices that are in harmony with each other, although by no means are they the same voice, nor are they the same perspective. Far from it. There's a humorous photograph of you as a youngster with your two talented sisters, and this is at a point in time when there does not seem to be at this point much talent in you. Tell our listeners about that little photograph.
Right. So there's this wonderful photo, and it's because we talk about Melanie, who had a violin put into her hands at the age of four, and she talks about that. And Melanie was a brilliantly talented violinist. But in Mr. K's world, talent was beside the point. He did not think there was anything, there was no such thing as an untalented child, simply a child who could work harder and focus and be more disciplined. And so when I became his student at the age of 10, I had flamed out. And the photo you're referring to just shows you kind of my lack of talent. It's a photo of myself with my two older sisters, one with her violin. She became a music teacher, actually, a brilliant musician. My middle sister, who's sitting at the piano, who was a brilliant pianist and flute player. And then there's me, where in a ballerina pose, even though I didn't take ballet, because my dad's taking the picture, and, like, it was hopeless. I had no talent. He's like, put your hands over your head so it looks like you're doing something.
Well, eventually, of course, you are united with the viola and with Mr. Kopczynski, and the rest is history in many respects. One of the things that one of you says about, I think it's you, at one point in remarking about his approach, is that for Mr. K, there was no such thing as an untalented kid, just a kid who didn't work hard enough. And, of course, if you are teaching music with that perspective, then it's little wonder why Mr. Kopczynski brought such passion and relentless drive to the task. If this was about, in a sense, willing students of limited gifts to do well, there was no other way to do it.
That's right. And he believed in, you know, it was discipline and repetition and practice. My early music books are marked all over with his handwriting in giant block letters that just say, again, 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 which I swear was probably his favorite word, most used word in the English language was again. But it worked, and it was this concept that you can do better. And you know what it translates into, and I think at the end of the day, this is one of the reasons why he was so successful and why Strings Attached is resonating with people, is because as harsh as he was, what it really boiled down to was optimism. He had boundless optimism, in boundless faith in his students' ability to do better. And it gave us all faith and confidence in our ability to do better. So when I started the viola with him, even though I'd flamed out on the piano and had there was no sense I had any talent, I was so determined, and he put no limits on what I could do. It was always, he always had an expectation that I could do better, and I always wanted to do better. And his highest compliment, because he didn't compliment this, his highest compliment would be not bad. And if you got a not bad, you were dancing down the street, and you'd go home, and you'd practice twice as hard. And what it did is it gave us all confidence in ourselves, and that kind of quality of perseverance and self-motivation. All these things that you hear people today saying, you know, kids don't have enough self-motivation because they're guided and told every, you know, and you have the trophies for everyone mentality, so people don't learn how to kind of fail and pick themselves back up again. And those are all qualities that Mr. K taught us, that whether you pursued music or whether you went into some other field, those are the skills you need in life to succeed.
Hmm. Let's give our listeners just a quick little snapshot view of just how scary Mr. K was in rehearsal. I'm thinking, for instance, of one thing that I believe it's you describing, when your orchestra was contending with a fiendishly difficult piece, or it was fiendishly difficult for these young musicians, Brahms's Academic Festival Overture. And
yes,
you describe what Mr. K did when he was hearing some kind of wrong note somewhere in the violin section. Explain to our listeners what Mr. K would do in a situation like that.
So if Mr. K heard one wrong note, literally, he would stop the whole orchestra and he would scream, you know, he'd say, "Who is deaf in first violin?" Or sometimes he would say, "Who is idiot who play wrong note?" And it's funny now, but you know, it was slightly terrifying. But he was so hard on us, and he just made us rehearse again and again and again. And certainly, that some of his methods you couldn't get away with, nor would you want to today in today's world. But many of his methods are the research is showing actually he was right. Like a lot of things that we backed away from, because a lot of his methods are things that we kind of think fly in the face of everything we know about education. But in fact, the new research is showing that he was right. Things like repetition and rote, and things like allowing us to fail and pick ourselves back up again, and discipline and being strict. I mean, all of these things the research is now showing are actually the mark of effective teachers. And also, they also help the self-esteem and confidence of students, which is sort of counterintuitive.
Sure.
It builds their confidence.
We should say, too, that for as frightening as Mr. K was, in just what you described, there is also some humor in there. I mean, and the book is just full of these wonderful lines that he would throw out about, you know, when he would hear something that caused him dismay. I mean, he wouldn't just say that was bad or that was flat or you're rushing. I mean, he would find some intriguing picture, string together some interesting words, maybe even playing off the fact that English was his second language, to make the point in a way that, you know, even while it was on its surface harsh, there was something a little funny about it, which also probably helped it penetrate. Can you just give our listeners a sense of what I'm talking about there?
Sure. I mean, you know, he would say, he had these very funny sayings, you know, cellos sound like hippopotamus rising from mud in the river. You know, he had these ridiculous things. He had a very funny sense of humor, and he also had a huge heart, which there's a lot of humor in the book, but there's also so much heart. I mean, he would do things. In addition, you know, he was tough on us, but he had such love for the students and such passion for education. So he would do things for us. Like, you know, he had us perform all the time, but he would take us to nursing homes and to hospitals to play for the patients, and it really instilled a sense of public service in his students that I think lasted a lifetime. And I also think a lot of it came from his own past. I mean, he, as we mentioned, had this incredibly difficult private life that included a childhood that he never, ever spoke about in Ukraine. And we did a massive amount of research, actually, to find out about his childhood, which it turns out was spent fleeing. I mean, he was born right before World War II, and he spent his entire childhood amid bloodshed and destruction in Ukraine, fleeing from the Russians and the Nazis and the Poles, in refugee camps. He was starved. He was, his entire childhood was a struggle, not just, you know, to survive and also to finish the school year. It was so hard for him to get an education that when he finally came here to the United States, he was already 19 years old. He spoke no English. He'd never had even a music lesson at that point. He loved music, but there was never an opportunity for him to learn music. And so he was so grateful, I think, to be in the United States and have the opportunities he had to learn English, to get educated, to learn music, and then to turn around and teach it to others, that I think that passion just overflowed. He had such gratitude for his life, despite all of its hardships, that just infected all of us. I mean, it really carried over to all of his students.
In spectacular fashion. And I love all the moments in the book when you share moments about sort of his soft, tender side. For instance, an experience where he brought maybe your quartet or some of the young players for the first time to play in a nursing home. and gently explaining to you how some of these older people might want to reach out and actually physically touch you, and that they're not around children often. It would mean so much to them. And I just love that window into the tender corners of his soul, of this guy that was otherwise in so many ways scary to you. I want to finish with a question that has really been on my mind as I have read your wonderful book. I happen to be a teacher of music. I'm in my real life, the rest of the day, I'm a professor of music, a voice teacher, actually. And when I look at the list of sort of principles that guided Mr. K, things like strict is better than nice makes me realize that I'm actually a really nice guy and not all that strict, and that in so many respects, I am poles apart from Mr. K in the way that I teach music. And I'm really struggling with that. And I don't want to make this about me, but I think a lot of music teachers would read this book and react the same way, and particularly public school teachers at this time when the arts are kind of under fire and many of them are treading lightly. There's probably part of them that want to be more like Mr. K. Do you think it's that this is the kind of music teacher he needed to be because this is who he was? Or do you feel like all of us who teach music should be more like Mr. K, even if that's not really who we are when we just sort of roll out of bed and our natural selves? Would you want music teachers, no matter who we are, to sort of reach deep into ourselves and find our inner Mr. K as we're working with our students? I wonder if you've thought much about that.
We actually, Melanie and I thought a lot about this. And I think where we come down is that clearly there's no one size fits all for teaching. And Mr. K's younger daughter, Stephanie, became a teacher who embraced so many of his methods, but she was also incredibly kind, and she was not a yeller at her students. But I think that the bottom line really is, you know, the subtitle of the book, it's Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. And I think that great expectations, that to me is the bottom line. The unifying factor for all of these great teachers is that they inspire and that they expect a lot of their students in the same way Mr. K expected a lot of us. And it showed he had his very strict methods, but I think that great teachers have that belief in their students and the passion for their subject, and those are the things that give the student the confidence they need to succeed, the tools they need to succeed. And it really is, at the end of the day, it's optimism, it's faith in your student's ability. And I don't think you need to be tough necessarily to convey that, but I do think that it does have to do with having high standards and having the belief that your student can meet them.
Very well put. It's a terrific book and a stupendous story. Again, the book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And the book, by the way, is also full of wonderful and sometimes very poignant photographs that also bring this story to life. And Joanne Lipman, a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you, and congratulations on an absolutely terrific book.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you.
This weekend on the Morning Show podcast, we will, among other things, share with you an interview with John Eisenberg, the author of a book about Vince Lombardi's first season as head coach of the Green Bay Packers. He took over at the Packers at a time when they were arguably the worst team in the league. I played a portion of that conversation on yesterday's Morning Show, and it will air in its entirety as the Saturday podcast of the Morning Show. on Sunday's podcast edition of The Morning Show from the archives, a conversation with the author of a book called Trans Like Me. Next week in the broadcast edition of The Morning Show on Monday, part of the conversation that day will be with Matt Tomey, a 2017 Carthage grad who now works for the Sacramento Kings. And we will hear about the exciting work that he has done with them and some other professional sports teams since graduating from Carthage. On Tuesday, a historian from Elmhurst, Illinois, talks about his brand new book called The Hidden Places of World War II. On Wednesday next week, Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business from Carthage, joins us for his monthly visit to talk about current events and issues. On Thursday, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and with her will be P.J. Leish, who is with the State Entomology Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll be talking about the way in which insects manage to survive the winter. And a week from today, I speak with the author of a book called Writing the Big Book, The Creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.